Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another awesome episode of the Biff Bites podcast. I'm your host, Jerry Mee, joined as always by my faithful co-host, Mr. Adam Scheer. How's it going, Adam?
Jerry, I'm feeling game time. It is game time.
It is time to play everyone's favorite quiz show, good old Question Palooza.
Whoop, whoop.
And this is double action. We're bringing you twice as many questions as we did on the last iteration. For those new listeners with us who haven't been with us for a while, the episode before every exam cycle is our Question Palooza episode, where Adam and I go through and break down a bunch of test questions and kind of give you guys a little bit of a peek behind the curtain, talk about what we think about when we're answering these types of questions. Try and help you guys get into the question writer's heads just a little bit.
Yeah, these are really well received. It's a great time with you buttoning up your studies to hear some extra question action. And we've put together two times the fun. So for each key CFP exam area, you will have a couple of questions. We also throw in a bonus one on top, make it a baker's dozen. We did the coin toss, right? We did the old coin toss, Jerry, and it looks like you won. So you're going to lead off here.
Yes. Yeah. So Adam's going to hit me with some questions. We each kind of picked our domains, got some good example questions, and we're just going to kind of trade off. So not necessarily in order here, but we'll be jumping around a bit. But hey, that's what the exam's like too. We're going to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, so we'll start off, like, let's just get into it. No need for delay here. So Jerry is first up, and I have queued up a couple of general principles of financial planning questions. Before we launch in, Jerry, I want your take on GP. In your experience working with students, tutoring students, how are they faring with general principles? Is this an area you feel like they got under wraps well? Do they need some work?
Generally pretty good, which is a good thing because it makes up the bulk of the exam. You know, there's a lot crammed into GP. It's definitely the jack of all trades of the topic areas, because you got everything from behavioral finance to education planning to practice standards and code of ethics. There's just a lot that they can throw at you and still have it fall under the GP umbrella. But for the most part, a lot of it is kind of, you know, I don't want to say common sense, but just common practice, I think, is probably the better way to put it. It's where people's experience can definitely help them out a lot. And outside of education calculations, there's not really a lot of difficult math in the topic. So I think because of that, most students get GP pretty down pat. Whenever I look at student scores and they come and they talk to us after the exam and, you know, kind of share their experience, very rarely do I have a student tell me that, oh man, those GP questions just absolutely killed me. Yeah. Really the only time that comes up is maybe sometimes in the behavioral finance sections, they kind of say, it was a little subjective. But other than that, GP tends to be a pretty comfortable area for most people.
Yeah, so with these, it's just about putting in your reps, and as we always tell people, just nail that code and standards down, know that inside and out, which brings us to our first question. So Jerry, me leading us off here. Jerry, each of the following are types of qualitative information obtained in step one of the financial planning process, except, here are your answer options: risk tolerance, health status, life expectancy, capacity for risk.
Yeah, this is a good one for a couple reasons. Number one is watch out for that double negative. That'll trip a lot of people up. You know, we're looking for all the types of qualitative information except, and a lot of people, their brains will just filter out that except, and they start looking for qualitative information types in there, and then they end up getting the question wrong because they don't slow down and read it carefully. So this is one of those key examples of a double negative changing what you're actually looking for. The other reason why this is such a good question is because I've seen this come up time and time again, testing the difference between risk tolerance and capacity for risk. That's a very popular nuanced difference that the CFP board loves to drive home. But before I get into those, let's just talk about the two other wrong answers. Health status. Now, that one is very obviously qualitative information, you know, how you're feeling and whatnot. That is your health status. That is qualitative. Life expectancy, that one can definitely be a tricky one because a lot of people, when they think of life expectancy, they think of a number like, oh, you are living till age 90 or you're living till age 85. But the CFP board very clearly outlines in Appendix 3 of the roadmap that life expectancy is a qualitative piece of data. And that's because we don't really know what someone's life expectancy is in a pure number form. It's not like I can tell you, oh, you know, you are definitely going to live till age 85. You know, we think, you know, based on your family history, based on your medical status, based on your healthy living, we think you might live to 85. But really, what we're talking about when we're talking about life expectancy is that kind of overall quality of life and how that leads to the length of life. So don't get tripped up by that. Don't just zero in and focus on just the number of life expectancy. Instead, think about all the things that go into giving an estimate for that number. I know that's definitely something that I've fallen victim to myself. So be careful of that. Life expectancy, very distinctly outlined by the CFP board as a qualitative piece of information. Now, to the meat of this question, risk tolerance and capacity for risk. On the surface, that's potato potato, right? Right, Adam? You know, those seem like two of just two ways to say the exact same thing.
For sure.
But there's an important nuance here, and what it comes down to is once again the quantity, being able to assign a number to something, versus the quality, the subjective nature of something. And capacity for risk is a quantitative piece of data because I can say to you, Adam, you know, I have a capacity to lose 50% of my portfolio before I pull out. You know, 50% is my rug pull moment. That's what I'm getting out. I am assigning a hard number to it. I am telling you 50% is my tap out amount. Whereas risk tolerance is, I could say to you, Adam, I have a very strong stomach for risk. I can take a lot of risk. I can take a lot of market ups and downs before I get nervous. So I'm fine leaving my position in the portfolio. Two ways to really say the same thing, but I'm saying it in two very important different ways. And that really demonstrates the difference between qualitative and quantitative. And that's why I think the CFP board harps on this so heavily, especially with those two examples, because of how closely they look on the surface. But once you dig into it, you realize just how different they are. So I'm going with capacity for risk is the black sheep of these examples. It is the quantitative piece of data.
Bingo. Spot on. Great explanations about each one of those and breaking them down. Yeah, that Appendix 3 is great as a resource for your planning process. And what we love about it here at BIF is that it really breaks down those details that they're looking for beyond just you're supposed to obtain information about the client's quantitative and qualitative information. I mean, that's well and good. Oh, it's about the numbers and it's about the subjective personal bits. Great. But they really spell it out in that roadmap. So good call out there, Jerry.
Yeah, it's especially the life expectancy one too. Like before I read that roadmap, I would have sworn life expectancy was quantitative, just because you're so focused on that number. You're so focused on your life expectancy is X and not thinking about everything that goes into that.
Yeah, great stuff. And a really good takeaway here. For all you out there, just because a question stem is short does not mean that there's a lot of complexity buried into it. I mean, this was one sentence and we had four options, and you still got to process all that. You got to reason through. And Jerry, you laid it out there nicely.
Excellent, excellent. Should we round out the GP? Let's hit out another GP, and then
Yeah,
we'll
let's
mix up the topics.
knock it out and then we'll just move forward. All right. So, here we got Horatio, Jerry. Horatio maintains a margin account currently valued at $100,000 and a cash account worth $450,000 with Midnight Blue Investments, an SIPC member broker dealer. Calculate the total SIPC coverage provided to Horatio.
Good one. SIPC or SIPC, as I have heard it mentioned in the industry. I always like the SIPC crowd. Kind of the redheaded stepchild because FDIC insurance gets all the love. Everyone pays attention to FDIC insurance, everyone drills it, and everyone forgets about poor old SIPC, SIPC insurance. But it's still very, very important, especially because you get a little bit more coverage with SIPC. You get $500,000 of with SIPC insurance compared to only $250,000 with FDIC. That $500,000 though is separated into two categories. You got $250,000 of cash and $250,000 for securities. Now, remember also that this is in the instance of a firm going under. If you make a bad investment and your investment goes down, you do not get to file an SIPC claim asking for that money back. That's not how that works. This is for instances in which the brokerage firm, goes under and takes all of your portfolio with it. SIPC would step in those situations. So we got 250 of cash, 250 of securities. Now, Horatio here, he unfortunately is not getting the full $500,000 of coverage, even though he has a margin account at 100,000 and a cash account of 450. That cash account is only getting the $250,000 of cash coverage, and then his margin account is going to be fully covered because that's under 100,000. So we take the 250 from the cash plus the 100,000 from the margin, giving us a nice clean SIPC coverage of $350,000. Final answer.
Ding, ding, ding. That is spot on there. That is the way we handle SIPC. Jerry, nicely done.
Excellent. Yeah, important one. Don't sleep on SIPC. Like I said, FDIC gets all the love, but you could still get an SIPC question thrown in there. All right, Adam, should we up the difficulty? Let's go into everyone's favorite tax planning. And now, Adam, same question for you. How do you feel students are doing with tax?
This it's tough to say across the board. I know in our program, it's something that from the get-go, we are focused on building strong foundation in some of those tax basic principles. We really emphasize, what are the common tax areas that you're going to see as a planner with 3 to 5 years experience? And we really hone in on those. That said, it's always a question mark for people, even as they go deeper. And it often takes a lot of really focused reps and study to build that confidence before the exam. I've been reading people saying, all right, well, I'm low in tax, right? My scores are high across the board, they're low in tax. Now's your time, if that's one of your areas, to spend the rest of your prep heavily focused on that, and then supplementing with your review items from the other areas you're stronger in. So it's tough. It's really tough to say. I mean, we have in our program some people that are practicing CPAs, right? Or enrolled agents, and people that just know this stuff inside out. But we also have people who, are pretty boldly share, hey, I haven't done a whole lot of this in practice, and I'm feeling a little bit lost. But the good news is that all of us were there too, and it is doable. It's doable to go into this exam not being a tax pro and knowing the right stuff to get you to the finish line.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd say tax is the category of extremes. Like you said, we have practicing CPAs taking this exam, and then we have people who their old reliable is we don't offer tax advice at this firm.
That's right. That's right. Call the CPA. That's been the the question, you know, the answer to all questions that you'll hear from people. Well, we don't do it that way. We just call the
Well, they're
CPA.
gonna do it on the exam,
Well,
so you gotta learn.
you got to pick the right question that's offered to you. So, yeah, it's interesting in that with studying tax. All right, it's 14% of your exam, right? So it's one of the higher weighted. It's actually moved up in the ranks over the years in terms of weighting, which means that more people in practice are doing tax related things, which I think is a great thing. But it's the hub, it's the knowledge hub of all CFP stuff because tax finds its way to every other domain that's out there. There's always an overlap between the two. So a good way to frame this is, yeah, I'm hyper focused on tax, but I'm also getting really great reps in insurance, retirement, estate, investments, because there's always a tax element that's in that pool somewhere.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I cannot avoid taxes, you know, death and taxes, as they say.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'm ready, Jerry. I'm ready to test my tax knowledge here for the folks.
All right, I got some good ones for you.
All right.
So Jalen has recently purchased an old factory in Milltown, USA, and intends to convert the space into apartment lofts. Jalen is a hipster. Which of the following best categorizes Jalen's new factory slash apartment building?
Okay, so he's got a factory, right? Being that he has a factory, it's actually two categories. So if we were to put it's not just like building, right? Jalen has a building. Yes, he does, but this is part of the challenge with taxes that they have different words for different things, right? So we have to not look at the building as it's building. We have to look at it as tangible property. And why is that? It's tangible because it's physical, it's real. Like you can go inside of it, right? Buildings, natural resources, equipment, those are all examples of tangible property. The building is also real property, and that's probably a little more familiar to everyone out there. We hear about real estate or realty. That building is a piece of real estate, it's real property. So tangible, real property is what best categorizes Jalen's old factory that's going to get switched into the art lofts, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's tangible because you can touch it, and it's real because it exists. So there, those are kind of two words for the same thing, right? You know, what's the nuance there?
I mean, it's the buildings. We're going a little more specific, right? So
Okay, so like
real
tangible is
property.
like the land itself,
Yeah,
and
the
then
things you can
real it.
touch, right? It's like anything touch you that you can, you know, that's there physically, right? So it's not an idea or IP, right? Or copyright or something that like that's the thing, right? That's the
Right.
property, intellectual property, right? So that you can't put your hands on on
Right.
the idea bubble over your head.
Right. So
That's one category, right?
like Jalen's business plan here. So like the blueprints that they drew up, you know, the idea they're gonna turn this into this, you know, hipster paradise with coffee shops and high ceiling lofts and all that. That is intellectual property, whereas the building itself is real
It's
property.
real. Yep. Real, physical, tangible, real is the way you would go with that set there. Yep.
Okay. Excellent. Like it. I got some more real estate stuff for you, Adam. In a, you know, I just got houses on the brain, you know, for the past year, just
I know
never
you
goes
do.
away. In a qualifying like-kind exchange, Joseph realized a gain of $55,000 and received $400,000 of net boot. Select Joseph's recognized gains on the transaction.
All right. So this is one of those like kind Section 1031 exchange questions. And I hope for everyone out there that this is the question that you pull if there's any sort of numbers that are involved. The questions in the CFP pool have been drifting in general to more conceptual type questions. And that's a good thing, right? With these 1031, at least as it applies to these 1031 exchange questions, because these calculations are notoriously difficult. If we were to map out a full Section 1031 exchange calculation, just mapping all of the property from one place to the other, and we want to find the basis, right, all the way at the end of it, it's a five-stepper, and it's really tough. You have to memorize the names of each segment.
Oh, I draw pictures. Pictures to keep
for sure.
Straight.
That's the way to really conquer these, is like, this is going here, that's going there.
Yeah.
And then the math becomes easier, because we just, I mean, even if you are a hyper mathlete, like, you can't do this stuff in your head, because you have things going from one party to the other, and it's tough to do all the accounting. So Jerry's spot on. You'd map them out. What this question comes down to with Joseph is he had a realized gain of 55K. He also received boot. Now, when you receive boot, it's stuff that is not at the core of the trade. Because what we're doing here with 1031s is you are exchanging realty for realty, so real property for real property. But there are times where it's not balanced, right? So what people will do is they'll throw in extras. They'll sweeten the pot. And those sweeteners are called boot. And boot could be cash. It could be an automobile. It could be inventory. It could be a mortgage that you're transferring. So it's all these different things. And what we're looking here with recognized gains. So this is actually a 1035 or 1031 exchange that has gone wrong, because ideally you want these things to swap, and you don't want there to be any recognized gain. The whole point of doing these is to defer the recognition of gains on the trade until way down the line. So if we're here, somebody screwed it up. I'd be calling the intermediary and I'd be like, hey, what's going on here? Because Joseph needs to actually recognize some money, and he has to pay taxes on it as a recognized gain. The rule here is to find the recognized gain. It's the lesser of the realized gain or net boot received. Lesser of the two. We'll say it again. Recognized gain in the 1031, lesser of realized gain or net boot received. In this case, it's the net boot received of 40,000. Somebody mixed up the exchange, and Joseph's going to have to be recognizing that as a gain on his taxes.
Yeah, good stuff, Adam. And yeah, exactly. This is just an example of one of those that looks like it's a complicated math problem, but then as soon as you really dig into it, you're like, oh, you know, it's just the lesser of the realized or the boot. That's all you need to know. No math involved. All you need is that one simple fact, and you get this question right with flying colors.
100%. And it's so good you brought that up, Jerry, because if you're feeling stuck on this, what I'll often say is, know what makes up a 1031 at its core. And post 2017, it has to be the reason for the exchange is one building for another building, right? Or realty for realty. But also know your timelines. There's a couple of timelines that you need to memorize. Understand what boot is, and then understand what you just said. It's the lesser of the two is what's recognized. And get that, master that before you start going deeper and into the more complicated stuff. Save that stuff if you want to go into accounting or for the enrolled agent stuff. You do have to go deep, and you have to know how to calculate these out. But for the CFP exam, remember, keep this in perspective. Knowledge of a planner that has been doing personal planning for 3 to 5 years. It's not as if this stuff isn't, I mean, it's done often enough, right, with real estate. But is that going to be at the heart of what you're doing as a planner with 3 to 5 years experience? I can reflect and I'd say I would want some senior advisor managing that, and I'll watch from the sidelines. So just know the basics. You just need to have your general awareness. Know the general points, and if you feel like you got that with confidence, then go deeper into the calculation. Jerry, you are up, and we have some insurance stuff for you on the docket. So, Jerry, if one party to a contract fails to perform its duties without a legal excuse, The contract is considered blank. I have four options for you.
Okay.
Void, voidable, illegal, or breached.
Oh, see, this is a good one because this is an example of people going, oh, I don't need to study this. This is common sense. I'll get these right. And then they get a question like this on the exam and they're like, oh man, I should have studied this more. And I know that because I was in your shoes a few short years ago. I was exactly that was my thought process as well. It's like, oh, this stuff's easy. It's just basic definitions. I'll get this right, no problem. And then you get something like this, like, man, all of these are good answers.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So it really does come down to the nuances and the context of the question. So if one party to a contract fails to perform, they failed to perform their duties. So they have breached that contract. It's not that what they did was illegal. All they did is, you can fail without doing something illegal. But they still breached that contract. And it's not void or voidable because it's not like some judge stepped in and said, nope, can't have it. This isn't okay. We're voiding this contract out. It's not allowed. That didn't happen here. All that happened is some individual just didn't do what they were supposed to do. And so because of that, they breached that contract. Now, there may be legal consequences for that after the fact, but if we're just talking about here and now, the contract itself, this is just a simple breach of contract.
That is spot on. Solid description there, Jerry. And man, those contract law stuff with insurance, put it on the note cards and just drill these things. You know, that's the way that I know that I learned it, that a lot of students learned it too. 'Cause it's pretty tough.
Yeah. And like I said, don't sleep on it because,
Yeah.
this is exactly one of those ones, you look in and you look in the like the textbook and it says a breach contract is when one party fails to perform their duties. And you're like, duh, everyone knows that, obviously. And then you see it in the context of the question, and then you start getting a little fuzzy on your memory. And it's like, oh, maybe that was void.
Yeah.
Maybe that was. And that gets really fuzzy in the heat of the moment.
Those question writers are not going to give you a bunch of layup options and then one that is clearly the option, right? They're going to be close enough so that you second guess yourself to really test your knowledge on it.
Yeah, they are. They are.
Well, speaking of which, let's do another one.
Okay.
All
Another
right.
definition. Let's see it.
All right, this is an insurance. This is contract law. Here we go. Jerry, a contract executed with a minor would be blank.
Oh, very
Answer
good. Same
options.
options, void, voidable, breached,
And
illegal.
invalid here. Yes.
Oh,
All right, so you got a
invalid.
new one.
Oh.
Invalid. Okay.
Ooh, okay, invalid. That's a little bit more tantalizing than illegal. I am gonna go with voidable, and this is really nitpicking on this question. So, first of all, it's not gonna be breached because it's not like someone failed to perform what the contract says. For all we know, both sides of the contract could be doing exactly what the contract says and everything's fine, except for the fact that it was executed with a minor. So breached is out because it doesn't say about anything failing to happen. Now, invalid is also a tempting choice, but I'm not going to go with invalid for the same reason that I'm not going with void, is that interestingly, you can enter into a contract with a minor, and as long as that minor is happy with the deal, it can continue on, free and clear. You can go to the end of the terms and everything's great. The downside of entering into a contract with a minor is that because the minor is not considered to have legal capacity, at any time that minor can choose to void out the contract and say, you know what, this wasn't in my best interest. I don't want to do it. So it's up to the minor's choice. So this contract is voidable. It is possible for the minor to void the contract out if they want, but it does not automatically void the contract, and it does not automatically make the contract invalid just because it was done with a minor. So that's a very, very nuanced definition style question. You really got to know your stuff to get that one right.
Sure do, definitely. All right, why don't we let's this is where our bonus comes in. This is where the baker's dozen. We're gonna stack one more in here for you in insurance,
All
Jerry.
right.
All right, so assume Noreen names her daughter Adrienne the beneficiary of her $7 million life insurance policy and transfers the policy to her 5 years before her death. If Noreen retained the right to borrow against the policy, the $7 million death benefit will be included in which estate? We got four answer options for you. Noreen's estate, Adrian's estate, the contingent beneficiary's estate, or none of the above.
Yeah, good one. This is what I would call a red herring style question. The CFP board knows that everyone has the 3 year rule top of mind. I don't know why, Adam, but I've just noticed that students just latch on to the 3 year rule and they like apply it in situations where it has no context whatsoever. But they're like, oh man, 3 years. I know 3 years is important. That I got to do 3 years. And so they look at this question and they say, oh, she transferred it 5 years before death. We're good. We're scot-free. It's definitely going to be an Adrian's or Adrian, Adrian's, however you say that name. It's definitely going to be in her estate. And what they do is they get so focused on that, they miss the next sentence in this question that if Noreen retains the right to borrow against the policy, that is the pitfall here. You know, when is a gift not a gift? You know, it's like, hey, Adam, I got this sweet new Lamborghini. And you know what? I like you so much, Adam. I'm going to give you this Lamborghini as a gift. Here's the thing, though. I'm still going to be able to drive it on days that end in a Y. Have I actually given you a gift of a Lamborghini? No, it's not. It's a gift in name only. And that is what Noreen is doing here. She may be giving this $7 million policy to her daughter, but because she retains the right to borrow against the policy, she still has an incident of ownership. And that's the legal mumbo jumbo that means, guess what, Noreen? This policy is going to be in your estate when you die.
Yeah, it really is. It's amazing how tricky some of these inclusion in the estate type questions can get, just like you said, by just blending in a timeline, because people do immediately go to that 3 year rule when it's almost a distractor here. It's because it's the ownership that's getting tested. It's not the timeline. It's the fact that she's retained control of the policy. If I have any control over any property that's out there, it's likely going to find its way into the estate somehow. One of the ways we move things out of the estate is by ceding the control, putting it into an irrevocable trust in a way that makes sense and is going to accomplish that goal of removing it from the estate. But good question here, and nice breakdown, nice breakdown.
Right. All right, let's move on to some retirement, Adam. And we're getting long in the tooth, so I'll pick up the pace a little bit. I
Yeah,
got a
sure.
quick and straightforward one for you. What is the absolute requirement for a qualified distribution from a Roth IRA? There's lots of options, but which one is absolute?
It is absolutely a timeline, and it is absolutely 5 years. It's a 5 year holding period for a qualified distribution. You must have that in place. Okay, so other factors, right? Death, disability, becoming age 59 and a half, first time home purchase. These are possible qualifying circumstances, but you can't do anything unless you meet that 5 year holding period at first. And as is always the case with the Roth, your basis can always be taken out at any time, right? The amount that you've put in. We're talking about just is this according to the definitions qualified 5 year holding period? And that's my final answer.
Yep. Nice, quick, easy one. Remember, guys, Roth IRA, 5-year holding period. It has to be met.
Got one more in this retirement domain.
I got one more in this retirement domain. It's another definition one.
Okay.
What are the components that count towards a plan participant's annual additions limit for defined contribution plans? Loaded with vocab in that question. You got to know your vocab words.
Yeah, this is something that we should ask ChatGPT next time we sit down
I know,
with
right?
ChatGPT, because there's a lot of jargon in here, and I think it could be very easily misconstrued by the robots.
Yes.
Fortunately, we've studied our CFP materials. We are familiar with what this means, right? And what we're really looking at the end of this is, did anything happen in that defined contribution plan throughout the year that would allow us to say someone was an active participant, right? So there are three guidelines. We can either have employer contributions, right? So the employer is going to give a lump sum into the plan for the employee. So that's one, employer contributions. Employee, you can have elective deferrals. So you can sock money away in your 401k profit sharing plan if you'd like. And then finally, reallocated forfeitures. I would say of the three, this is the one that gets a little funky, right? So
Yep.
the plan has the option to reallocate forfeitures out to other plan participants. And if you happen to receive some of those forfeitures with a DC plan, that is going to trigger your annual additions limit. You're going to be an active participant. This really comes into play when we're looking at spousal IRAs. That's like the first thing that comes to mind for me is when we have this set of information in a question, and then they're asking for the deductibility of a traditional IRA contribution.
Yep.
So, good need. I mean, this is need to know stuff. I would just put this on a flashcard and repeat, 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 say it out loud. But those are the three. What do you think, Jerry?
Yeah. See, I always remember this. You know, Mike Long has taught me many things over the years, and this is a really good one he's taught me because he has a funny story about how he had a job years and years ago, probably while I was still in diapers. And he has this story where he got 53 cents of reallocated forfeitures, and he was so upset because that 53 cents made him an active participant and he could not make an IRA contribution and save, you know, hundreds, thousands of dollars on his IRA deduction because of a measly 53 cent reallocation forfeiture. So because of that story, I always remember reallocation forfeitures. Thanks to him.
That stinks. That
Yeah.
stinks for him. And we are in your favorite area of investments, and we got two good questions queued up here. Let's get to it. So let's kick things off. If a bond's conversion ratio is 75 shares of stock per bond, and the price of the stock is $12.75, would it be beneficial for the bond holder to convert?
Oh, good question. So this is another one that looks complicated, but if you know a couple key facts, it's actually super, super easy. So don't get intimidated by these types of questions. So first thing we need to know is by default, bond value is always par $1,000. Unless this question specifically states otherwise, you're always safe to assume that the bond's par value is $1,000. So if you get 75 shares for each bond when you convert it, all we really need to do to figure out the value of that is take that $1,000 par value and divide it by 75. So 1,000 divided by 75 gives us, let's see here, it is $13.34 per share. So we can take our $1,000 bond, We can chop it up into 75 pieces, and those 75 pieces become individual shares of that company's stock. But it's not quite a good deal because if we chop that bond up, it's going to cost us $13.34 per share. But instead, we can just go out on the market and buy that same stock for only $12.75. So doesn't really make much sense to chop that bond up. You know, remember, bonds have certain benefits. Number one, they pay a yield, which is probably higher than any dividend payment that this company is owning or paying, I should say. Also, bondholders are debtors, which means that they have priority over stockholders in case that company gets dissolved. So it makes more sense to leave that bond as a bond and wait and see if that stock climbs in price. Now, if that stock climbs up to $14, $15, then yeah, cash that bond out all day, every day. But as for right now, it does not make sense to do that. It's not beneficial to convert.
Correct. And I wish that I had heard that when I was preparing, because this was one of those areas, you know, sometimes that it just doesn't stick. And for whatever reason, there was a roadblock here, but you explained that really well. And now I know. So now all you should know as well, listeners.
Just easy peasy. Take $1,000, divide it by the number of shares that it converts to, and then just compare that answer to the market price and see if it's higher or lower.
Bingo. All right. One more for you in investments, Jerry.
All right.
An investor would use an exchange traded fund or an ETF if they believed in which of the following?
Oh man, I feel like I hear Mike on the wind whispering, you know, strong form.
Yes, exactly. Strong form all the way, all day.
Exactly.
all right. So, investor would use an ETF if they believed in actively managed investments,
Not quite.
inefficient markets,
Okay.
passively managed investments, or the ability to outperform a benchmark.
Well, right off the bat, I can narrow this down to 50-50. I can eliminate two absolute wrong answers, and that's actively managed investments. If I would like to actively manage investments, I would buy a mutual fund over an ETF. You know, that's really the key difference between those. And then the same with the ability to outperform a benchmark. That's kind of a more nuanced way to say actively managed. You know, if I just think the market is perfectly efficient and, you know, the benchmark is what I'll get, I should go with an ETF because an ETF is basically, you know, a benchmark, you know, is what it's going for. Whereas the mutual fund is actively managed. They think that active management gives it a leg up and gives it some outsized returns. So if I think if it was possible to outperform a benchmark, I would probably go with a mutual fund over an ETF. So right off the bat, those two answers out the window, those are wrong. Now, inefficient markets, I still think that falls under kind of the ability to outperform the benchmark. It's kind of a more shrouded way of saying that, but I don't think that is correct either. And so that leaves me with my correct answer, passively managed investments. And that strategy is something I think a lot of students don't take advantage of as much is, you know, just go down the list and eliminate the wrong answers. It's a lot easier to choose a right answer from a list of three or two than it is to choose it from a list of four. So always, always, always try and eliminate the wrong answers first and simplify that question a little bit.
Bingo. That is right, Jerry. That's your ETFs, right? They're trying to replicate an exchange, right?
Yeah.
Underlying benchmark.
Passively managed investments.
Okay. So we got two more till we're at 13, I think, here, right?
It's
Two more to close
true.
it out.
Good old estate planning, st
Oh
finishing
boy.
strong.
That's right. That's right. Let's go.
All right. A mother owns a stock with an adjusted basis of $10,000, which has been held for 3 years. She gifts this stock to her daughter when the fair market value of the stock is $15,000. 2 months later, the daughter sells the stock for $15,000. Identify the daughter's basis and holding period.
Got it. Okay. Very common line of question. And there's a couple things in the checklist, the mental checklist to track here. So number one, is this a gift or was it sold? Right? Because there's going to be different treatment possibly depending on if that happens. In this case, we have let's see, she owns it. She gifts the stock. Okay, so I open up my set of gifting rules. Now, I know from my CFP studies that if you gift appreciated property, that there's a rule that kicks in. If you gift lost property, there are three sets of rules that click in that depend on where that's eventually sold. Fortunately for us, the adjusted basis was 10,000. Mother gifts to daughter when the fair market value is 15,000. So we're dealing with a gift of appreciated property. Then we just enter the rule. The rule with gifted appreciated property is that the recipient of the gift takes the basis, the original basis or the adjusted basis from the donor, and they also take the holding period. So don't be misled here, right? There was a 2-month interval between the date the gift was received and then the date that the property was sold. That is there solely to distract you. Okay. That could come into play if we're dealing with lost property, but that's not the case here. This is your baseline gift of appreciated value type of question. So basis is going to be 10,000 here. Holding period will be 3 years.
Yeah, perfect. Excellent answer. And yeah, just like you said, don't overcomplicate it. Sometimes the questions are as simple as they look on the surface.
That's right.
All right, last question here to finish us out. Under the special use valuation provisions of Section 2032A, if a farm or closely held business qualifies for the special valuation, an additional estate tax will be imposed if a qualified heir sells the property within blank after the descendant's or decedent's death, I should say.
All right. Yeah. So another group of concepts that can be really challenging to layer in, especially this far along. But I do think it's important to know some of these valuation-based estate planning items as you're preparing for your exam. One of them happens to be with 2032A. So this is just a special provision that allows owners of farms to have the property valued differently, okay, in a nutshell. And what happens is you have to qualify for that special valuation. So by special valuation, it's not going to be valued at the fair market value. It's going to be some reduced or adjusted amount that ultimately is just going to keep the estate value intact. And when I learned this originally, one of my instructors had said that one of the things you'll see throughout some of the estate planning stuff and through some of the tax stuff as well is that the Internal Revenue Code does have places where they're specifically helping out different groups, and farmers are a big group in that. So 2032A deals with farms or closely held businesses, and what they're saying is you have a qualified heir. Right? That's just going to be someone that's close to you, someone that would take over the business. They have to meet a time period in order for that to kick in. They cannot sell that property within 10 years. It's a 10-year time frame. So you can get that 2032A preferable treatment with the valuation of the property. But there's a contingency, and that means that the heirs or the qualified heir must hold that property for another 10 years. I grouped this with 6166 as another IRC section, also 303 for different stock redemption. So just take a look at those quickly. Just wrap your head around what those are, what they mean. And then take the final step to think, all right, how would this look in an estate? Why is this a good thing? And then try to drill down into some of the rules like this. Like, this is a unique rule for this section of the IRC. But the correct answer here is 10 minutes or 10 minutes, 10 years.
Yeah.
We wish it were 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Hold that thing for 10 minutes, sell that off.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And yeah, I really think these are the types of questions where understanding the backstory of how they came into effect really helps you understand the concept as a whole. Like,
Yeah, definitely.
for example, like we live in New England. There's lots of family farms in New England, famous Vermont dairy farms. And, I remember growing up next to Drumlin Farm and all these farms in New England that are generational farms. But because we live so close to Boston and New York and what have you, property values have exploded. And so the problem is, these farms are on a lot of acres, and acres are very expensive close to population centers. So when, the farmer dies and tries to leave the family farm to his kids, the family gets hit with these massive estate tax bills because it's valuing the land as if it's being developed into condos or something like that when it's just a simple dairy farm. And so, Section 2032A comes in as a way to kind of give them a hand, helping hand is, hey, you don't have to value this land as if it was going to be developed into condos. You can value it as it is as a farm. But the trade-off of that is you have to maintain it as a farm for 10 years. You can't just, well, I don't even, you don't even have to necessarily maintain it as an operating farm or anything. They just don't want you selling it off
Can't
to a
sell it.
condo developer, within 10 years. Because the whole purpose is, if this keeps happening, well, then we won't have any farms. And then, what are we going to eat if there aren't any farms? So they're incentivizing people keeping these kind of family farms going so that we have, good local food sources.
Great explanation there. If I'm one of the listeners and I'm studying for my CFP exam, I'm making a little note about the local farm that has been a generational farm in Northwest Connecticut that me and my family go to, called Averill Farm. It's an apple farm, and we go there during, the fall, and we get cider and we get cider donuts, and we make a day out of it. But that's what I'm writing on my flashcard, is right. I'm writing Averill Farm, and that clicks this concept in for me. So you're so right, Jerry. Like, putting this into real world stuff, like getting it out of the Internal Revenue Code and putting it into something that's more personal and that you can really relate to, helps those points stick.
Way better than special use valuation provisions to Section 2032A subsection. Like, you're never gonna
Yes.
remember that, but you're gonna
No,
remember
no.
Averill Farm.
That's right.
Exactly right.
And they're
Exactly.
apple cider donuts. I mean, I told them year round, offer these things year round, man. They are so good. Yeah, it's a highlight of our fall. But I think that's it, Jerry. Question Palooza times two plus one.
Plus one, plus one. Always, the Biff crew is always throwing you that extra value. We're all about value here.
About value. All about value. That's right. So, any thoughts for these March test takers before they march into their exam, Jerry?
Yeah, I mean, I gave a pep talk to the Biff students yesterday. So I'm going to just kind of repeat what I said during that is, you all know more than you think you know. You're all climbing a mountain to the CFP goal, and you have your sights fixed on that mountain peak, and all you can think about is how much further you have to climb in order to master that, in order to get all this knowledge you need for test day. And you're losing sight of all the journey, all the distance you've already come. Take a minute to look back. Think about all you know now compared to what you knew a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. Think about everything that you've learned in the last year studying for this exam and realize that, man, you know a heck of a lot. And you're going to be just fine when you take this exam because you have spent all of that time dedicated to mastering this. And now all it is to apply it and get that pass.
Perfectly put. Yeah, just go get those marks, and I think just read carefully, read slowly, and what I tell everyone, just show the board what you know, right? This can feel really intimidating because of everything you put in, but just go show them what you know. It's really, really just about that. And yeah, Jerry, really well put. Hoping that this really helps helps each of you get some extra reps in. And wishing you all the best. Be sure to let us know how you did.
Definitely let us know. Well, good luck, everyone. I hope you all have a great test and really look forward to celebrating with you afterwards. Study on.
Study on.